chapter 20, verses 17 to 28, and that is on page 995. So chapter 20, verse 17. And as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside, and on the way he said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and he will be raised on the third day." Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom." Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those who for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
Hannah, thank you very much, and welcome to this last in our series, which I've called Educating Peter, but has been given a number of titles over the last 3 weeks. My latest is A Crash Course, or A Crammer, on Grace. You'll remember that the disciples who have been with Jesus for 3 years still have not really grasped that grace lies at the heart of the kingdom. And Jesus is literally on the point of heading into Jerusalem to be crucified. And immediately before his death and resurrection, he needs to give these disciples, who still haven't quite grasped it, a crash course in grace. We've seen the decent materialist in week one: you get into Jesus' kingdom by grace alone. We've seen the energetic activist, or the committed convert: we need to keep being reminded of grace as we go on in the Christian life. And this week we come to what I've called the devout careerist. It's not actually Peter, so it's not quite Educating Peter, is it? So it didn't quite fit. But the devout careerist, who needs to realise that actually heaven is a place of grace. I think, I suspect this has been the most challenging to me anyway, of all the talks we've listened to, in terms of my thinking and understanding the devout careerist. First then, the appearance of a worldly devotion that has lost sight of grace. And under this point, I want us to get right under the skin of the Zebedee family, who we've just had read to us in Matthew 20, verse 17 following. Let's look first of all at their devoted discipleship, shall we? Because we need to understand that they really were a devoted family. Look at verse 20. First of all, notice that James and John are very much involved in the request. Verse 20, she came with her sons. Verse 22, Jesus replied to them, you plural. And verse 24, that the other disciples were indignant at the brothers. So the heading in the Bible, a mother's request, I think is a little misleading. I think it's the whole family. Notice that their request had this appearance of devotion. That's why I call them devout careerists. Look at verse 20. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked for something. Now, you shouldn't make too much of one word, but that little word kneeling is a technical one in Matthew's Gospel. We first hear it of the wise men right at the beginning, who come and kneel to pay homage. And it speaks of genuine worship and adoration. So they knelt. They recognized Jesus as God's mighty ruler, and they prayed. Notice, too, that they really do appear to have understood something of the Christian message. I think they recognize who Jesus is here. Verse 18a, Jesus says, "The Son of Man will be delivered over." And I think they've seen that Jesus really is the Son of Man, God's King. verse 19, at the end of verse 19, he will be raised on the third day. They must recognize that he's God's king and that he's going to be raised to rule. Otherwise, they wouldn't have said in their request, when you come in your kingdom. So they really do believe that he is God's king. Now, it's important to pause there, isn't it? Because when we look at these corrective passages, it's possible for us to paint the people being corrected as such sort of idiots, such baddies, that we would never associate with them. And if we do that, then we'll never see that this is an instance that we might ourselves find ourselves falling for, even at St. Peter's Barge. You can imagine what they did that. But they've been following him for 3 years. Haven't they realised that already? We'd never do that. But as we look at the Zebedee family at prayer, I think they look really rather impressive. The mother prays, all three of them pray. The mother believes, all of them believe. The mother follows Jesus, all three of them have left everything to follow Jesus. And so if we bumped into them at the first meeting at St. Peter's Barge on a Wednesday lunchtime or up in St. Helens, we'd say, look at their devotion, look at their commitment, look at their understanding. They appear to be genuine disciples. I think they are. They are elders on the church leadership team. They are at the prayer meetings. They come to Wednesday lunch every week. Maybe they even give the talk. Certainly, James and John have been sent out on mission by Jesus already. But as we begin to get under the skin of the request of these disciples, there is something really defective in their discipleship. So what I want us to do now is to look at that. We've looked at the devotion of their discipleship. Let's have a look at their defective nature of their discipleship. As I've thought about this incident, the thing that has struck me most forcefully is that James, John and their mother have an inadequate view of heaven. Now this is slightly surprising, and therefore I've tried to make us work hard the last few weeks. This is no exception this week. I want us to work hard at the text for a few minutes. And I want us to see that the Zebedee family want to be in Jesus' heavenly kingdom, in the new world that Jesus talked about last week. But they want Jesus' heavenly kingdom actually to be little different to this world. So what they want is that Jesus' family and his kingdom in heaven should be a place of glory and power and prestige without it being a place of selfless service. In other words, that it would be in all respects like this world, ruled over by a rather worldly leader. Let me tell you now, as we begin to approach the text and see this, that this point has generated an enormous amount of discussion on our staff team at St. Helens. And there's been a lot of kind of working it through until we came to this conclusion. The way to get right under the skin of some of these interchanges between Jesus and disciples is to look at the answer that Jesus gives. Sometimes the question is a bit ambiguous. But the way to understand how the question was understood by Jesus, and therefore what was behind the question, is to look at the answer he gave. He obviously understood the question. And Jesus' answer to the disciples comes in verse 25. So the question is there in verse 21. Say that these two sons of mine are to sit one at your right, one at your left in your kingdom. The answer comes in verse 25. Jesus called them to him and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and that their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. The little word lord it over means literally to become master, to gain dominion, to subdue. Whatever you see, master it. Master your doubt. Don't allow yourself to be mastered by anybody. It's that kind of word, yeah? Getting dominion, power. The word translated to exercise authority, I am told, carries the sense of using, maintaining, and keeping a position of mastery once you've got it. So once you're top dog, then making sure you actually stay as top dog. So then Jesus' answer in verse 25, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Suggests that the request and the ensuing trouble with the disciples is full of ambition and pushing and wanting to gain mastery. So the two disciples with their mother come to Jesus. And, Jesus, you're the one that dishes out the honours. When you come in your kingdom, I wonder if I could possibly be just a notch above the others with slightly greater privileges. And then once in that position, well, then I will fight to make sure I remain as top dog. That's why I call this worldly devotion or devout careerism amongst the disciples, because it looks so devoted as they come on their knees to Jesus. They believe, they kneel, they pray, they follow. But in reality, it is just essentially a worldly devotion. There's virtually nothing different between that and what's going on in the world. That is what's going on in the world, isn't it? I mean, I was talking to somebody about their office just recently, and they said that is exactly what their office is like. Driven, jostling for position, always with an eye on the next rung up the ladder, constantly restless. In fact, they were talking about their boss, wanting to climb above the person below them. And that is just what our disciples are doing here. Not, Lord, how can I serve? But what's in it for me? How can I increase my position of power in this little group? And fascinatingly, just like in your office, it produces exactly the same response amongst the other disciples. Look down at verse 24. When the 10 heard it, they were indignant. Grief, indignation, displeasure, disunity, division, dysfunction, an ugly, unpleasant group to be part of. Why, if heaven were to be like that, what would it be? Hell. Now, I think we're ready to apply this first point about the defective discipleship of our worldly devotion careerists. I've thought long and hard about how we should apply it as I've thought about this passage, and of course it would be easy, wouldn't it, to look at the established denominations with their bishops and archbishops. Enthroned is the language of what happens when you become a bishop, living in a palace, wearing a mitre that looks like a crown, and sitting in the House of Lords. It's not exactly the language of a servant, is it? Easy pickings. We could dwell on the kind of picture painted in the BBC dramas like Pride and Prejudice with Mr. Collins, always with the rich, wanting to sort of get his position of preferment, the greasy little man that he is. We could come a little closer to home and begin to talk about a church member who looks to the church elders and deacons and expects the eldership of the church to serve them, with the eldership here to meet my needs and make me feel good about myself, rather than joining with the eldership of the church in serving the Lord and other people around us. Now, you get a lot of that in churches, don't you? It's not surprising in our consumer culture that people could see church as a place where I will be served, I'm in it for me. And I suppose we could apply this, couldn't we, to a committed person at St. Peter's Barge who really sees, what can I get out of it? That's worldly devotion, defective discipleship. It's not the kind of discipleship of the kingdom. So we could apply it in those areas, but I want to apply it in the area that our passage applies it. You can see the application right in front of your nose. How does the worldly devotion appear in the passage? How does it appear in the passage? Well, it appears there in verse 20. They came up to Jesus, they knelt and prayed. So it's worth asking, isn't it? How worldly are my prayers? How worldly are my prayers? The question is not in my prayers, how might I serve others, or how might I hold out God's offer of grace to others, but how might others serve me? Lord, please would you give me this, and please would you give me that, and could you give me the other, and the other, and the other, rather than, Lord, how can I serve? Please make me more of a servant. Show me this morning how in my office or at the barge or as I come to the lunchtime talk or as I go away and in my family, Lord, how can I serve? Do you know, I was thinking of doing rather a naughty thing and beginning the meeting by asking those of us who do pray, and some of us may not pray, but asking those of us who do pray to make a list of the things we've prayed about over the last week. And then coming to this point and saying, well, how worldly are my prayers? The defective discipleship of these devout careerists. There's the warning, the appearance of worldly devotion. The devout careerist who has lost sight of grace and is seeking to advance self rather than reach out in gracious service. Let's move now, shall we, from the appearance to the antidote. And the antidote to worldly devotion lies in fixing our eyes on the cross of Jesus. For the thing that the disciples have failed to grasp is that in God's kingdom, greatness is not measured by how much power and authority you can gain over someone. It's measured by service. For heaven is ruled over by the servant king. And heaven is peopled by those who have been served by the servant king and then learned to serve. And until we've grasped that, our view of the Christian faith will always be defective. So let me ask you, as I think we began really, what is your view of heaven? What kind of place do you think heaven will be? See, I think my view of heaven has all too often been rather Islamic. I've seen heaven as a kind of procul harum, bacchanalian feast, with me at the centre being offered bunches of grapes. But when you stop to think about it, that view of heaven is just worldly. It's a continuation of this earth, fighting and indignation, jealousy and greed. God's kingdom isn't like that because God's king isn't like that. And that's why this passage is full of talk of Jesus and his death. And particularly talk of Jesus as the Son of Man going to his death. Because we've said before, the Son of Man is the big title in the Bible for God's mighty king. But all the way through this passage, we're having it driven home that God's mighty king is the mighty king who died on the cross. Don't worry about that. We'll listen to your trading deal and see if we can pick up a few good tips. Verse 18. Just come back to verse 18. See, we're going up to Jerusalem and the Son of Man will be delivered over. Verse 22. You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? Verse 28. Even as the Son of Man came. Not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So that Jesus is wanting us to see here that heaven is not a worldly place where people push and jostle and fight and stab one another in the back. Heaven is a place ruled over by the servant king who came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for heaven. That's what makes it heaven. Heaven will be a place where we serve one another if we belong to Jesus. It's so different to the world, isn't it? Heaven will be a place where the mighty ruler is one who's shown himself to be at his very essence, his very heart, a servant who gives himself selflessly for us. The cup in verse 22 refers to God's anger. The Son of Man in verse 28 speaks of God's Lord and ruler. And in verse 28, Jesus spells it out, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Drinking the cup of God's judgment at all that you and I have done wrong on our behalf. Draining it to its dregs so that even if we just trust Jesus, all his anger and judgment at everything we've done wrong in our life will be wiped away by the servant king. But the point is, he does it as king. That's his very nature. His essence is one of selfless service. And therefore, heaven has to be a place of selfless service. Now, look, I've illustrated this, I think, wrongly in the past, and I will give you the wrong illustration, and then you can tell me why it's wrong. I'm not going to ask you to speak up, by the way, just in case you're worried. Up in the city there is an individual you may have heard of called the Lord Mayor of London. It's not Ken, it's somebody altogether different, the Lord Mayor of London. This year it's someone called Michael Savory. Each year there is a ceremony, you may be aware of, where the Lord Mayor gets changed over. So it's an annual appointment. It is a remarkable ceremony. Everybody is dressed up in the most bizarre clothes. People carry bunches of flowers. I think that's because in the old days the populace used to smell so bad. They spread lavender on the floor. And if you've ever been part of it, you keep expecting Mother Goose to appear, or at least Frank Bruno to emerge from behind a pillar. Part of the ceremony for the changeover of the Lord Mayor is the one of the sheriffs, again, don't worry about that, there are sheriffs in the city, one of the sheriffs steps forward and ceremoniously strips the Lord Mayor of all his badges of office. The chain of office comes off, his badge is removed, his cloak is peeled away, and eventually he is left, just like everybody else, a mere commoner. So he arrived in a Rolls Royce, driven by a chauffeur, surrounded by the power and prestige of his position. He leaves a mere commoner. Actually, he doesn't. He leaves in a Rolls Royce, but we won't go into that because he's very rich. Let's not worry about that. Imagine, okay? Now, I wonder if you can spot the problem. See, the trouble with that illustration is that as the Lord Mayor is stripped of all the badges of his office, he ceases to be Lord Mayor. But what we're being told here is that Jesus came as Son of Man, as Lord, as King, as God's heavenly ruler. And as Son of Man, he descended and emptied himself into the very form of a slave and went to a cross in humility, nailed there, and drank the cup of God's judgment at your sin and mine as Son of Man. Now that tells us something about heaven, about the very nature of Jesus, about the very nature of God, that at his very heart is selfless service. Well, we need to conclude. If you're here investigating the Christian faith, I wonder if you've had a wrong view of heaven. Maybe you've never wanted to be there because you thought it would just be like your office. Jesus shows us that heaven is completely different to that. Imagine being served by others joyfully and enjoying their service and loving serving others for eternity. It's glorious. If you're here as a devout disciple, I wonder how worldly your devotion is. You come on a Wednesday, what's in it for me? I see it as an oasis in the week for me. You know, it'd be great just to begin to have a right view of heaven, and therefore a right view of Jesus, a right view of heaven, and therefore a right view of the Christian life. How can I serve? You might want to ask those sort of questions around the table if you're at that sort of table. How can we serve one another? Let's pray. Jesus said, "It shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave." Father, thank you that you've shown us your very heart, your glory, really, that you choose in your love and goodness to serve us. Thank you that you have served us ultimately by taking away our sin. And we pray, Lord, that you would help us to be shaped by the cross of Jesus as we hear this next series on the cross, and in our turn to live lives of selfless service. For your name's sake. Amen.